Welcome to the Leadership Trap Podcast, recording live from Austin, Texas. In this podcast, we explore the conditions that lead to surviving and thriving in a successful leadership role. We examine the traps that can cause leaders to stumble, bumble, or get ambushed in ways that may or may not be of their own making. I'm Dr. Chris Petrovka, and with David Hewen of Austin WorkNet, we have a conversation with each leader that explores the traps they've encountered throughout their leadership journey. Hopefully, it brings a new perspective to your role as a leader and helps you navigate your own way through the traps. Thanks for joining us. Let's jump into the trap.
And today's guest, Catherine Morris, an industry leader in employment law, workplace investigations, legal training, and HR consulting, basically an all-around legal badass. But hey, David, let's not mess around. Let's jump right into the trap.
Thanks, Chris. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Leadership Trap. So, Catherine Morris, icon of the Central Texas region, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. What do you think are the consequences of leaders missing the social moment? And there have been many social moments over the past few years, but what are the consequences that you see routinely get leaders in trouble because they miss the moment?
Well, I think the consequences are that leaders are removed from their leadership positions. I think we've seen it over and over again. We saw it in the aftermath of the hashtag MeToo movement. Frankly, it wasn't even the aftermath. We saw it throughout the entire movement. That the pace of change seemed to have slowed. We have a huge cultural movement right now with the Black Lives Matter movement and a workplace work environments full of young people who are feeling woke, if you will, and leaders who are going to have to understand, have their pulse on this movement, which is still evolving. So I think it's critical. I think that throughout the years, we've seen these different moments in time that have challenged leaders. Some have moved with the movement and others have been swept away by the movement.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that in a moment, but we should talk a bit more about you so our listeners have a frame of reference. You've served in legal capacities in-house with major companies, Samsung, Applied Materials, Motorola, as well as on the corporate legal firm side of things. So you bring a well-rounded perspective, and you're especially well-known as being a go-to person because you have a very practical way of looking at the business side of things and how the business is impacted and not just dryly stating, here's the law, and you're going to have to live exactly by the law. This is what I've always admired about you, and many others do as well.
Well, thanks, David, and thanks for calling me an icon. And I feel very good about myself right now. But I will say, in all seriousness, the fact that I've spent the first part of my career, as many new lawyers do, working for big law firms and specialized in employment law, getting this formal training. And then I took a pivot, as you mentioned, to a number of in-house counsel jobs and spent 20 years in various corporations. My last corporate stint, I spent 10 and a half years at Samsung Austin Semiconductor as their local general counsel, but also doing a lot of employment law during that period of time. I'm back in private practice now at Ina Kiever, which is so fun for me because I love having these 20 years of in-house experience and now applying that in a law firm type of environment, because now I have an idea after so many years of practicing law of what really is going to, I have a sense of what's going to be problematic for companies and for individuals, as opposed to this clinical approach sometimes you take after you spend so much time in a law firm, because you just sort of see how these issues play out in companies. Having a leadership role at a different company. So it's fun stuff, actually.
Well, thanks for framing it in that way, because I want to revisit the question I just posed to you about leaders missing the moment as these social movements start to gain significant momentum and find their way into the day-to-day operations companies. What should companies be doing to preserve the leader's integrity, where they may not even realize that they're a part of a systemic issue on diversity or equity, inclusion, that they are part of the problem, and they may not even be aware of it. You know, the supposed I'm not a racist response doesn't always serve someone well because they just don't realize their actions or systemically what they put in place that's exposing the company. So what should companies do to heighten awareness?
Well, I really believe in the investment in training. And there's so many different tools available to companies. And so depending on the size and the amount of money. So, but why wouldn't you want to invest in? You companies want to have a high-performance culture. They want to have accountability. But they have to bring the tools to their leaders, in my opinion. And so I think that's what companies can do for a start. But I do think we need a bigger vocabulary to talk about some of these issues, because I think, particularly if we talk about the Black Lives Matter issue, which is creating a great deal of defensiveness in individuals and in certain leaders. And it's going to be tough. And we're going to still see, I think, over the next year, how this plays out. But we can pivot back to the hashtag MeToo movement.
Okay.
If you will. And I think that what happened there, I think many leaders looked around and thought, okay, this is serious. I need to pay close attention to what's going on and pick up on the cues. But many others just said, look, this is who I am. Everyone knows I'm joking, or this is my personality. And everyone's going to experience my personality just unfiltered the way it is. And that hasn't worked out all that well for a lot of folks.
Yeah.
And I've got a kind of a fun example to share with you.
All right.
And it's one involving, it's not a case I worked on. It's out there. People can Google it. But it involves a guy named Ray Kelvin. And Ray Kelvin is an Englishman who founded the company Ted Baker, which is a sort of fashion dynasty, right?
Right.
And He builds this. He starts with one store. His mother helps him, man the cash register, and builds up into this empire. Well, at the beginning of 2019, Ray Kelvin was pushed out by his board of directors out of the company he founded. And the reason he was is because he didn't adapt. He was tone deaf to the changes that were sweeping across workplaces around the Western world. And what he would continue to do was hug employees indiscriminately. From what I've read, I truly believe that he wasn't a predator. He was out of touch. He didn't get the fact that that folks just didn't want to be hugged all the time. And apparently had this line that you would cross coming into his work area. If you crossed it, that was called the hugging zone. And he'd hug people and simply overstepped boundaries with people. And some folks complained as an investigation was done and there was no going back.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think
these guys, hey, I'm a hugger. Come on. Come in for the hug.
Yeah. He was a hugger. He kissed some cheeks too, and he actually would shake some people on his knee. That was a little bit hard to justify. But the bottom line was, here's a guy who I think that most folks realized that he wasn't an evil, bad person. He hugged everyone. It was men, women, employees, visitors, journalists. But it was outdated. It was outdated behavior. He missed the moment. And as a result, painting with too broad of a brush, but the way I interpreted this is he didn't stay current.
Yeah.
And his conduct was not current. And he doesn't run his company anymore as a result.
Well, you point to a certain type of behavior that I recognize, and Chris, you may have recognized, we could have even talked about this, is that some leaders become so successful, they grant themselves license because they believe their success should overshadow anything they say or do simply because they've earned the right to say or do most anything. What you're describing reminds me of the founder of Papa John's, who ended up saying some really inappropriate racist things. And he was out. The board sent him out of the company. So we do see these things. And sometimes I wonder that just the sheer ego and the veracity of the individual can lead to this circumstance. Let's play with this a little bit more on this lack of awareness and sensitivity, but I'm going to shift it a bit around to the multiple age generations within organizations and how different types of companies and cultures and leadership may approach age in ways that, again, they may be blind to it because they think they're doing the best things on behalf of the company, and a little bit of success has fed those behaviors. But what are you seeing in terms of ageism in the workplace that especially is concerning?
Well, it's an interesting topic. And I think that the way generations work together in the workplace, and, you know, we probably have four, even five generations in some organizations working together with the Z generation, maybe just about to graduate from college and serving as internships, the millennials, Generation X, boomers, and even maybe silent generations in some places, such as law firms, honestly. And so how do these folks all, you know, weave together and work in a way where they understand and are respectful about each other's work preferences, how they want to be treated, how they want to be respected, and so forth. So a couple things. With regard to ageism, and this is very interesting, is you have more and more organizations which now are being led by millennials. And if millennials are not in the top leadership role, they're the dominant population of individuals in companies. And, you know, you could just ring off the sort of the top 10, right? Top brands that we all know of. And very recently, I represented an individual who sort of kind of got ousted from their role at this organization after being recruited within the 2 years prior to their ousting. The company spent a lot of money relocating this individual that was not a low-level position this person was given. They were highly specialized, and they weren't asked to leave because of their performance. It was a complete lack of awareness upon the individual I represented about why they were unsuccessful. That person still doesn't understand it. Like, what happened? What went wrong? No one told me. And I'm quite certain that the company was scratching its head and saying, how does this person not understand how to work with all these younger employees? And I think it was a situation where coaching was necessary. I mean, this company gave up on this employee. And it could have very well been framed as an age discrimination case in a way. Ultimately, an amicable resolution was reached. But I think the issue here was that this executive who ended up leaving really didn't understand that, I'll just call millennial employees, doesn't have to be millennial, it could be second wave Generation X, are not as hierarchical as boomers, perhaps. Have worked, you know, they're not as formal, that they want to say, I want to, you know, that they want to work on projects that might not be in these particular lanes. You know, boomers like to stay in their lane, right? Hey, this is my job. This is my lane. And so I think there's a very different way of interacting. This isn't good or bad. It's just different.
Yeah.
And understanding that this person really did not have the tools to work in this particular culture, which was a much younger work culture than anything this person had been exposed to before. Okay. Yeah. So it was a failure to communicate, a failure to understand, and so forth. And it was unfortunate because the leadership of this company, I think, it failed the company really by not understanding that this person didn't have to lose their job.
Right. And I like the way you said it, the company, in essence, gave up on the employee, which too soon.
I think that's right. And I think that happens a lot.
Yeah.
In companies and I think it could conceivably happen more and more if we don't understand and recognize and address the fact that we've got folks in the workplace of very distinct generations who approach work, have historically approached work very differently. And how are we going to bridge those gaps?
Yeah, there are these purposeful leaders who are trying to shape a culture that is inclusive in as broad of a reach as possible. And because of that being a very purposeful approach to how they're shaping the culture, it allows for greater awareness of just these types of conditions. Because I know you and I have talked about how leaders sometimes hire out of comfort, right? This person, I remember teaching a class one time, and one of the leaders in the class, we were talking about behavioral interviewing and making sure you hire people that are different than you. And an executive spoke up and said, you know, I'd like to hire someone who's who I can take a have a beer with, I can take out for a drink. And I said, really? I don't know if I want to have a drink with all of my employees. Some of them are just so different than me, and we have such different interests, and they probably wouldn't want to have a beer with me. Shouldn't we consider hiring folks who are dramatically different? So do you find yourself facing leaders that have gotten into the habit of trying to build a culture that looks and feels like them, that they have shared interests? In, to their detriment?
Oh, absolutely. And I think sometimes that those organizations, or if it's a or entire companies or departments within large organizations, sometimes are referred to as the good old boys club.
Yeah.
Right? Where and it doesn't have to be the good old boys club. It can be any group of similarly minded individuals who just collect together because they're comfortable with each other. And I think that that's exactly what happens. And what I think is dangerous, what really becomes a trap, in my opinion, is that when someone what I think a big trap is that when you have leaders who have been allowed to perhaps only hire the people that they're comfortable with, they haven't been trained in some of these diversity, equality, and inclusion. When it comes to people, I think getting into the trap where they're only comfortable managing people that they want to go have a beer with, the people that share their interests, that look like them or look like, you know, members of their family or people that they socialize with, that's going to lead to a lot of misunderstandings when someone is introduced into the group that's very, very different. And that's where I've seen some traps, to be honest. Because when a leader is just fundamentally uncomfortable interacting with someone who's not like them, they have a tendency to ignore that person. And it's not motivated by antipathy or a bad motive necessarily. It's just discomfort. And I've had several cases really over the last year where the complaint of the employee, and they'll couch it in terms of race discrimination, national origin discrimination, gender discrimination. But if you dig down deep, it was fundamentally the manager could not relate to the individual. The individual felt ignored, and they filled in the blanks. This person doesn't talk to me. They never schedule one-on-one meetings with me. They act very uncomfortable. They don't say hello to me in the hallway, and it's because I'm different, whatever that protected class is going to be, when oftentimes the leader is absolutely not even conscious of their actions, how they're regarding this person, how they're coming across.
Yeah.
And again, I think that he's like, okay, what's the remedy to that? And I think it's introducing people to the concept of diversity and inclusion, making people understand it. It's not controversial. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but it's real work and self-work on the part of these leaders to keep themselves current relevant, maintaining a sense of self-awareness and awareness of the environment around them that's shaping itself in such a way that's going to impact the work environment. And if they don't do that that self-work, then they're not going to have an easy time to enter into conversations with employees. And where I'm headed with this is when you're working with leaders who avoid conflict, who avoid conversations, possibly because they're not comfortable giving bad news or tough news, what they think is tough news, whereas I would argue employees want to know where they stand. So tell me what I'm doing right, of course, but also tell me where I can improve. So I'm sure this gets further complicated if they're dealing with employees that have a different world experience or have lived a different life than them. How do you help leaders overcome this dilemma of avoiding conflict? And tell us a bit about the consequences there as well from your experience.
Well, I think you have to explain how high the stakes are. Mm. I've spent the last 30 years practicing law, and I think that one of the things that's not new is how badly it goes when a worker is surprised when they're told that they're losing their job because they haven't performed and they didn't get that message.
Yeah.
All right. And it doesn't have to be an ultimate employment action. It can just be that they feel frustrated in their career path and they're not getting this feedback from the manager. So I think that it companies, they must, okay, we're going to sound like a broken record, do a lot of training, but there's so many examples of where leaders have just, just buried their head in the sand, not had the tough conversations, and the whole thing blows up. And I just don't think that a leader today is going to have any success if they don't have, we'll call them courageous conversations with their workers. There's legal fallout for sure. But there's also the competition for talent in so many industries is so fierce that companies can't afford to lose workers because they get the feeling that their leader doesn't care about them. By contrast, that in my experience is my experience being an employee, and I think is my experience of being a leader of individuals when an individual has demonstrated to me that they deeply care about me as a person. Yes, they care about my career. They want me to do well. They want me to perform. They want me to be accountable. But they also convey that they care about what happens to me. They've cared about the trajectory of my career. I mean, my loyalty is through the roof.
Yeah.
And I've tried to mirror those leaders in my own leadership style. And I found that if we genuinely care, and I do care about the people that work for me, I mean, I guess we can call it servant leadership or what have you, empathy. I think that goes a long way, not only in engendering loyalty, obviously, avoiding misunderstandings and legal claims, having people work for you, give you the benefit of the doubt.
Sure. And I suspect, well, I know the answer to this already. Far too often, leaders come to you, senior leaders, executives, and say, Catherine, fire this person. Let's just get them out. And so you're naturally asking questions. In fact, I won't lead the witness here. What questions do you naturally answer when an executive comes to you and says, fire this person? What's your normal discovery?
I mean, I say, well, tell me about why you wanted to get rid of them. I mean, what's the performance history? Have they been given feedback? Are they aware there's an issue?
And how
long is this person with the company?
And how often does an executive say, oh, they know this? They know it already.
Everyone knows. This isn't going to be a surprise.
Yeah.
And I think that a penetrating, it's not going to be a surprise because you've let this individual know their job is on the line. And I think this type of conversation excites me because This is where you have a failure to communicate. There's individuals who think, oh, I've been telling this person that their performance is lacking.
Oh, yeah. They know this.
And then the employee in question knows he's been having some discussions, but it's just been like, yeah, do this, do that. You know, they're like, oh no, I'm just getting feedback and I've been responsive. I've been responding. I've been doing it. And at no time has anyone expressly said, no, you need to know, Susie, you need to know, Bill, your job's on the line. And unless a leader has that explicit conversation with an employee, I can assure you that out of all my years of experience, I can tell you that person's going to be surprised that they're losing their job.
Yeah, and this is such a fundamental thing that happens again and again, and it keeps you in business. This is job security for you.
Well, I should encourage these leadership traps. I mean, it's in my best interest to do. No, I'm teasing, of course.
I'm with you. Hey, by the way, with your illustrious credentials and background, you worked for some large companies, and I admit that in my experience with large companies, I find myself enjoying smaller companies much more. And one of the issues I find with larger company experiences, unless they really work diligently on some of these leadership issues we're facing, their culture, they have to really commit themselves to making sure that people stay engaged and feel like they are being treated with great respect and dignity, that leaders will often play the blame game. And I'm sure you've run into this. I assume you know what I'm referring to. But you want to elaborate on what's the blame game?
Well, it's interesting. I think that that's true. David, I've worked for many big organizations, so I saw the blame game played in companies with thousands of workers. The last 2.5 years since I've been back in private practice, I've represented some big companies, but also some smaller companies. And I would agree with you that the blame game seems to have been taken to a new level, if you will, or a higher level. It's more endemic. Maybe more nefarious the bigger the organization goes, and I think that's somewhat understandable because there's just so many.
Let's put some definition around the blame game. How would you describe it from what you see?
Okay, I would describe the blame game as a circumstance where something's gone wrong. Okay, different industries. It's it can be in a publication's gone on has gone out with. The dates are wrong for the conference they're trying to publicize. In the manufacturing world, a product's been scrapped. There's been a mistake in the manufacturing process, and this can result in a failure to ship the product in a timely manner or in a loss of money, and a loss of there's a power outage in the manufacturing facility. Something bad has happened. Okay, and emotions are running high, and everyone is on board to fix it. And what's really remarkable is just how awesome it is when everyone comes together in crisis, and they get past it. And that's the company at its best. And then the blame game happens, and people are going to do their post-mortem analysis of what went wrong, what do we need to do differently. And in some companies, there are leaders who are absolutely possessed with identifying who is it, what individual is to blame for this error, and they must suffer the consequences, all right? And more often than not, it's not one person's failure. There's a systemic issues with the company that unfortunately they've incentivized individuals to act in a certain way. And there needs to be wholesale changes across the organization. But then one individual tends to be scapegoated, and maybe they're terminated, they're demoted, they're cast aside, and it scares the heck out of everybody else. And I've often thought, gee, you know what? The next time this happens, everyone's going to be ready to point like, oh, they're to blame. And this person, it's not me. I'm going to get my defenses up because I don't want to go down like Joe did or whoever it is.
These become modeled behaviors of self-preservation then.
And, yeah.
They get repeated.
fear does not bring out the best in people, you know, and that's when the reptilian brain takes over and you're in fight or flight. And when you're thinking like that, you actually don't do your best thinking because you're releasing cortisol and you can't think. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow leaders think we're going to scare everyone in the organization. And that's how we're going to get the best performance out of everyone. And it doesn't work. It makes people want to quit or write really horrible reviews on Glassdoor about the company and their experiences there. And arguably, it could lead to legal consequences.
Okay, Catherine, we're halfway through here. Are you ready for name that movie quote?
I am ready. Hit me.
All right. Good. Here we go. We gave you a little prep, so you kind of know what you're walking into. And for our listeners, we like to have a little fun, usually about halfway through the show, just to mix it up for you a little bit. And we try to prepare every segment special for the guests. So this is name the movie quote. And we're going to have you name the movie quote based on either lawyers or lawyer-related films. So we'll see how well you know your lawyer films, all right? Here's the first one. Which movie is this? So before you come back here with another lame-ass offer, I want you to think real hard about what your spine is worth. Name that movie.
Wow, that is awesome. And that has to be, I'm seeing Julia Roberts and Aaron Brockovich. Am I right?
Yes, got it. That was the easy one. Yes. But that is a great quote, right?
I've been waiting to use that in a mediation all my life. Yeah, for the last 20 years, right?
I think that would be a classic line for you.
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll come back with your lame-ass offer while we're sitting here in mediation.
Yes.
Think real hard about what your spine is worth, damn it.
Well, that has to come from the movies because I don't think that actually can come out of my mouth. So
that's not the Catherine I know either. I'm a bit disappointed, Chris, that you didn't use your best Julia Roberts in person.
I know, right? Oh, gosh. That's tough. All right, here's another one. And our listeners at home, hopefully you're playing along as well. I discovered law again. You actually made me think about it. I managed to get through 3 years of law school without doing that. What movie is that popular quote from?
I'm not sure I know that. Is that that might be The Firm?
Yeah, that's Grisham. That's good. Yeah, another right. One that's a classic. That is one funny moment in there. Yep.
Early Grisham. Very early Grisham.
Yeah.
I know.
All right. You know your law? You know your law
firm? That was the first Grisham book I ever read was The Firm.
Who played the young lawyer in the movie?
Tom Cruise.
Yeah, that was a bonus question.
There you go. Yep. All righty.
Gene Hackman, Tom Cruise.
Two more for you. Here you go. Okay. He's the best lawyer in Miami. He's such a good lawyer that by tomorrow morning, you're going to be working in Alaska. So dress warm.
I'm stumped.
All right.
I don't know. Al Pacino or...
That is right. Tony Montana. Whoa. Scarface.
Okay. Well, it sounded like something Al Pacino might say, but...
That's good.
And he plays... Okay, all right. I feel like that's half a point.
That's good. Definitely half a point. All right, last one here. And probably my favorite one. I definitely can't do the imitation very well, so that doesn't help your odds. But anyway, you'll get this when I know it. I feel comfortable using legal jargon in everyday life. The actor whistles. I object. Number one quote from this movie.
Legally Blonde?
Yes, Legally Blonde.
All right. Are there some more games we can play? Because I'm really good at this.
So. I'm sure we'll have your prize earnings sent directly in the form of an embossed check that will be coming to your own.
Yeah.
Let me throw out some truisms and see how you react to this while you're on a roll here. Okay. How do you react to this truism that I find often used in the business world? From your perspective, your legal expertise, as a legal icon, what do you think? What's your reaction when you hear this term? Hire slow, fire fast.
I hate that.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do. I just, it seems so mean. And I'm like, so let me just say, if you hire slow, I mean, what an indictment on the person doing the hiring, in my opinion. So I'm going to hire slow. And in these days, what I hear is like people, you know, you have to go through 16 interviews to get a job these days. It takes months. Unlike back in the day, you know, you show up, you talk to a couple people, you get a job offer, you get boomed. So you're going to spend all this time, you're going to hire someone. And what does that mean to fire fast? That as soon as they struggle, I feel like that my whole example, as soon as they struggle, we're like, oh, let's get rid of them. It, as if it's a commodity. I mean, people's, okay, we're touching obviously on a sensitive point with me, but I've spent my career watching what happened.
Lost your heart a long time ago on this, and your tough legal mannerism would come through, and you'd say, oh, yeah, that's exactly.
Because you know what? Even as a young lawyer, I remember taking depositions of people who at the time were my dad's age who had lost their jobs, and they'd start to weep in their depot. It was awful. And I think that it created in me actually an empathy that I think the last thing anyone should do is take lightly terminating someone's employment because it messes up your life. All right. You're taking away your identity, the way you pay your bills. It is not something that's easy for people to get over, to be fired from a job. So and so the idea that we're going to fire. Yeah.
Why is this wisdom? And historically has been viewed as wisdom. And I would think a lot of your legal colleagues would say, oh, yes, absolutely. Hire slow, fire fast.
I don't know where that came from. Well, I don't believe in it.
I know where it came from after companies spending too much time avoiding firing someone when they need to fire them.
Okay. I agree with that. I think that yeah, this wringing of hands, from a legal standpoint, are you able to articulate your legitimate non-discriminatory reason for letting someone go? Have you performance management? Has there been a good faith effort made, if it's a performance issue, to remediate it? If it's a bad fit, you know, is there someplace else this person can fit within the organization? And after really exhausted the process, yeah, let someone go. But just to say hire slow, fire fast, to me, that suggests a cavalier attitude about terminating the employment relationship. And I think that anyone, we should be anything but cavalier about ending someone's employment. We should be thoughtful. Well,
hopefully you will appreciate this next one. Last one I have for you. Another leadership truism. People join companies and leave managers.
I think that's true. And I think it's unfortunate because the truth of the matter is if you believe in the company that you join, or and this would be more in I'm interested to see what you say about this, David, is it if you wait around long enough, your manager's gonna change and you're gonna get a new manager. Sometimes you just wait out the manager. And some people at different stages of their career, they understand this because they've seen it. Unfortunately, a lot of younger workers, they don't know that because they think 6 months is an eternity and certainly a year is an eternity.
And
they're not going to,
I was thinking,
and they're not going to wait.
Wait it out because the market's going to offer up so many other opportunities.
That's right. And so I would say that where there's a group of companies and we can kind of probably identify them. They're competing desperately for the same talent. And, you know, employees have choices and they're going to choose to not work for someone who is lacking as a leader.
Yeah. Yeah. You already know my bias that if we don't invest in a quality of leadership, then you can put as much as you want in terms of investment into the brand of the company, and you can do all sorts of slick things to position the company. But if someone wakes up in the morning and they hate their boss, the primary reason why they'll leave.
That's right.
They don't have an advocate. They don't trust the individual. They're not getting the information they need to do their job. And that accumulation of bad experiences will caused them to realize this is not a place where I can grow professionally.
I think that's right.
As we continue to pound away at these bad leaders, here's another framing of a poor leadership practice. We've run into the rogue leaders, those who consider themselves to be so wise, so aware, so much their own best counsel that they're often referred to as the rogue leaders. How do you find a way to recognize that and avoid the harm that may come from these very independent spirits that roam the hallways of companies?
Often the rogue leader, it's a double-edged sword because there are certain aspects of or characteristics of that leader's strengths that allows them to do amazing things for a company. Could be someone who's a great inventor, someone who is the best salesperson, or the ultimate rainmaker, right? And their success gives them a sense of license, right, to do things their way. And the problem is that's going to work for a while, but there's going to be a reckoning, right? Because the rogue leader is not going to be doing any self-reflection. The only feedback they need is the bottom line that they're feeding and getting rewarded for. I think there's a lot of tools. And, you know, this is that you utilize these all the time, David. There's 360 feedback.
Oh, yeah.
It's when people get, we turn and we shine the mirror on them. And those are sobering moments for individuals. To understand that they're perceived a certain way by their peers. And that might be a way that makes them uncomfortable. So, unless someone stops and says, wait a minute, this isn't okay, then you're never going to rein in the rogue leader. They're a legend in their own mind, okay, until it blows up.
I've advised a number of early to mid-stage companies, first-time leaders often at the helm, and I can recall so explicitly a leader and a board member came to me regarding an issue, early-stage company, and I helped them think through it in our conference room, and before they arrived, I looked up the company's website. It's a fun, funky website, really captured the spirit of this young in spirit, young in age company. I think no one was over the age of 20. And they had their list of campground rules, they called it. And one of their campground rules was, we will never have HR in our company. So I thought it was ironic. Here they were coming to an HR consulting firm for advice, and they had their campground rules up here. And they truly ran fast and loose. They would have offsites in Colorado. I assume you know why they chose Colorado as the ideal place.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah. So they would have sort of extreme offsites, we'll say. And there was a lot of free expression that the senior leaderships and leaders, including the CEO, was having, in which he was hitting on most of the women at the offsite. And sure enough, within months, he was out of the company because there were two different sexual harassment suits underway. The company ultimately folded about a year and a half later.
Yeah, well, I think that workers of all ages really actually want guardrails.
Yeah.
I think they're comforting. I think most folks thrive with a certain degree of structure. And then there's a big argument of what that structure looks like, how much of it, how much structure you have and whatnot. I think that, the rogue leader who thinks it's a good idea to take everyone out to play paintball or something, and this was a situation. But someone had a bad experience with, you know, guns in their life and they were traumatized or whatever. It's just, I mean, we can sit there and go, oh, you never can do anything. It's always going to, someone's always going to be upset. But I think it's just maybe a little bit, I think the rogue leader is maybe the ego-driven leader. It's about me and it's about what my specialness and so forth. And that seems to lead to some poor decision-making. And happily, work for me.
Yeah. You know, you were talking about the leaders trying to do things to make employees feel more included and having fun. I struggle with the right balance for leaders who want to feel like they are concerned and they care about the employees and they want to know about the employees' families and their interests. How do you ensure that a leader doesn't fall into the trap of expressing genuine concern and interest on the part of the private life of the employee and not being intrusive with that interest? Where should those lines be drawn, if they can be?
That's an interesting question because there's so many different personalities in the workplace.
Yeah.
I think that to be an effective leader, you have to read the room. And in leaders who can't lead the room, leaders who can't read the room are gonna struggle with that. They're not gonna sense discomfort. But I think that most folks are able to somewhat read the room, and in my experience, sitting down with someone on my team or where I've watched other leaders I've worked with express a genuine interest in that person's background, what they have going on in their life, whether it be their a child pursuing a rock and roll career, you know, as a singer-songwriter or pursuing, getting their medical degree or what have you, or someone, you know, who's playing Little League. And then you come back and ask about this. Actually, I think it's okay for me to mention his name because talk about icons, and the folks listening to here on this podcast might not be aware of Pike Powers, who was the managing partner of the law firm that I kind of grew up in, which was in which is called Fulbright Jaworski and now Norton Rose Fulbright in the Austin office. Pike was an amazing leader. The reason that even if you didn't work on his team, he would pick up things that you were interested in or about you. And he would always ask, tell me about how so-and-so is. And it just made you feel like he cared. And he did care. I experienced it one of my many, many years ago when my children became gravely injured and Pike, you know, showed up at the hospital. It just showed up. And I never forgot that. And I'm not saying that's appropriate in all these different organizations, but we're all humans. And I think we know when someone genuinely cares about us and expresses concern. And then we know when they're not paying attention. We know when they're waiting to just, you know, they don't really care. So I think that if someone's not genuinely trying to connect and demonstrate they have a sincere interest, it's going to backfire.
Yeah.
Okay. But I don't think folks should be too worried that by sincerely expressing an interest in their employee, they're going to go too far. How often does that really happen?
I'm with you, Catherine. I think employees are smart. People are smart and they can see through a genuine interest in caring as opposed to a falsely placed sense of caring, like they're checking a box of care. I mean, if someone walks by and says, hey, Joe, how's that drinking problem? I'm just curious. I mean, that may be an example of where they're not only a bit intrusive and maybe they've crossed the line. So I'm with you. There's an artfulness to that. But it comes from an authentic place, and people recognize that. I've got one more question for you. It's a moral dilemma. So, icon, legal icon, we've established that. If an employee tells you in confidence that she's feeling that her boss it's harassing her. She's sharing this with you in absolute confidence, but she doesn't want you to share this information with anyone else. Don't take this any further than a conversation with you. She's just making you aware of it, because her dilemma is that she started with a consensual relationship with her boss, and now she believes it's crossed the line, and it looks and feels like harassment to her. But don't do anything with this. What do you do under these circumstances?
That scenario is probably easier for me than it would be for someone in an HR leadership role, because as an attorney, you know, I have ethical obligations, and if I'm working in an organization as a lawyer, I represent the organization. That's my client. Okay, so you know what? I'm not going to be a blabbermouth about it, but I'm sorry, I can't live up to that agreement. You've told me what's happened. You've told me. Now I have an ethical obligation to take action to protect the company from liability. That's my job. My job is not to be everyone's friends or not to hurt anyone's feelings or not or make sure she's not uncomfortable. It's not my job, you know? So the bottom line is I need to take appropriate remedial action on behalf of the company. Is get an outside investigator, go to the head of human resources. I'm not sure what it would be, but just to say, oh, okay, well, let me know if you start to get, you know, more uncomfortable. That's not going to be okay. And I've never done, I mean, this has happened to me over my career. Maybe not exactly like that, but some scenario. And
so you tell the individual, I'm compelled to act. I have a duty to act.
You know, what I try to do in these situations is to reach an understanding that make it sound like it's their idea that we're going to do something, because I found that I'm not going to be very successful as in-house lawyer if I just, you know, ramrod over people and act in a sanctimonious way that I've need to go do this because I'm the lawyer person and whatnot. No one's going to come to me then. And that's not, and I want folks to come to me. So it does require, I think, a bit of finesse. Yeah. And you know, talk this person through. It's like, hey, I understand that maybe ask some Socratic questions and get the, how do you think, you know, what do you think is going to happen if this happens? And what, you know, and ultimately think, okay, we need to take act, get buy-in. You can't always do it, but I try to exhaust diplomatic measures in these instances.
And just to close this out, if you learn that the employee went to another leader, say a colleague of the leader she was having the affair with, and now she feels like it's crossed the line of harassment, and you heard indirectly, maybe from the leader that she had approached, what would you advise that leader if he's coming to you saying, she told me not to share this with anyone, and I'm struggling to sit on this information? How would you take that in your capacity? And how do you avoid a leadership trap for that leader?
Well, I think I need to let that leader know that you know, they, again, this is not a social organization. We're all employed by a company. We get paid to do jobs and to make hard decisions. And I think that we have to weigh it, you know, kind of really, you know, look at the individual circumstances, what really happened. But we, you know, leaders can't make those deals with employees to, under all circumstances, to hold their confidence. Keep their confidence to the greatest extent possible, but also taking the actions required to make sure that the company is protected. Because if it blows up and they're holding the bag, and like, yeah, I knew it, but I didn't say anything, you know what? It's not going to be a good outcome.
I'm with you. Well, Catherine, thanks for sharing your perspectives on the Leadership Trap series. This is a great conversation with someone who comes at this with a real sense of where the risk of leadership traps can get people in positions of responsibility and to loads of hurt, and the companies as well. Glad we had a chance to get you into the show. Thanks so much for participating. A real joy.
Oh, David, it was so much fun, and always fun to to hang out with you.
Same
and
here.
Now, and my new friend, Chris.
Thanks for coming on the show, Catherine. It's fantastic to host you.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. Do you know a leader who could benefit from hearing about the Leadership Trap? Well, we hope you will share this podcast with them. And remember, give the podcast a 5-star rating. Every rating helps us reach more leaders. You can find us at theleadershiptrap.org. Okay, we'll see you next time. And until then, stay out of those traps.